Hey, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. This one is notably longer than the standard format. And the reason for that is it's not just me talking this time. This is the recording of a session I did with a good friend of mine, Andrew Q, who is the head of platform engineering at QuadCore in the UK. Now, the reason that we sat down is that I think we'd been talking prior to recording the session about AI and the various implementations that have been cropping up, or at least that had been cropping up until that point in time, such as Copilot, ChatGPT, and so forth. And I felt that while similar, he and I held sufficiently different views that would make for a great discussion where we could both present our perspectives, hopefully challenge each other in a respectful way, such that both of us could review why we thought as we did. Were we still comfortable holding the positions that we were? Were we going to change them a bit? Were we going to update them, reassess them, and so forth? And I thought, well, if we could have such a great conversation about that topic, one that is, I guess, very prescient, especially in IT and the wider community, then maybe that would also help yourself and so many other listeners of the podcast. I hope you get a lot out of this. I hope you enjoy it. I hope that at least one or two of the things that we talk about challenges your position on AI, for better or for worse, and that you come away from it with a more robust opinion, and you're more sure of the position that you hold. Anyway, with that, it's over to the episode. All right, so where would you like to begin? Because you sent through, was it observability, developer experience, and AI and prompt engineering and prompt hacking maybe? Which would you like to start with?
I think topics around that, you know, because I think they're all quite fashionable is maybe the wrong word, but they are definitely, you know, topics that people are talking about. And there are things that we deal with all, you know, sort of on a daily basis with a lot of our customers and that. And so, you know, I found there were probably topics that were quite fitting, you know, at the moment. They kind of are ones I'm passionate about. I wouldn't say AI is necessarily what I'm passionate about, but it's. I think they're. You know, what we're finding is how things are coming all together. Like, you know, it used to. Sometimes it can be a topic. It's like this is one topic, that's one topic, but actually, they merge. You know, that Venn diagram of similarities where they actually do merge. From the AI perspective, we're finding, you know, different use cases where it can be quite useful rather than just using it as is, adding it as an almost a complementary tool to something that's been done already for so long is where we're sort of finding, you know, at least at the beginning, good sort of use cases of being able to use the technologies, you know.
Can you expand on one of those use cases?
Absolutely. So one of them would be around, you know, incorporating AI into observability. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think one of the things that have changed quite a lot over the last number of years is, you know, often, I mean, you always have full stack developers, you know, and guys who understand the full stack, but there are still a lot of teams and companies where the developers just build their product, their, you know, their API, their whatever, and don't really worry about what it runs on. But I think more and more as stuff has gone to containerization, they need to understand some aspects. Or if they want to be able to debug or check, you know, how their API, let's use API as an example, is doing, they need to have some understanding as to what it's running on. They don't need to be able to administer it or set it up, but they need to have an idea. And I think that's changing quite a lot as companies are moving to full containerization and serverless. So, you know, observability in the traditional sense, I think, was originally, you know, just your platform teams or maybe your run teams that were using it as getting a sense of health of the overall maybe ecosystem. But I think, you know, now what's happening is that developers need to be able to use the tools to view how their APIs are looking and faring and what they can do to improve theirs or if there's an issue. So, you know, because of that, I think there's a lot of pressure on the platform teams where the developers have to keep asking them. But if the developers were given the power to be able to do it themselves, almost a self-service, then it would take that load off of the platform teams. And that then starts the whole topic of, well, then the developers need to understand serverless. They need to understand how that works, how you debug it, how you, but that's quite a big ask. You can't expect all of your development teams to understand platform, you know? So this is where the AI side of it comes into it. And, you know, I'm working with a company out in Israel who are actually building this tool. And effectively what it does is it takes from the observability or the context of the issue. So be it if we're in Kubernetes, be it your pod YAML definition, your, you know, pod logs, maybe the Kubernetes events, maybe some metrics as well, you know, so let's just say CPU memory, and taking all of that context, passing it along to AI, and then effectively saying or asking AI to say, you know, help us. Obviously, you're going to do it with when there's an issue, like a pod crashing. Like, why do you think this pod is crashing? You know, and then seeing what response comes back. And what it does help with is because it's got all of the contextual information, what we've seen already is that it often spots issues that we hadn't noticed originally, just looking at it ourselves, you know. And because there's a lot of data points that you do have to have a look at and then understand Kubernetes and then understand your application that's running in the pod, like there's a lot of things you need to understand to be able to go, oh, well, actually, this is what the problem is, where we're finding AI is able to, I guess, process all that information and suggest some issues, at least of where to look at, you know, start looking at. It doesn't necessarily give you this is how you solve the problem. Maybe that's going to come down the road. you know, here's a PR with the change you need to make. Review it before I deploy it. You know, that will probably come. But you know, we are seeing some really impressive results from just doing this as a almost like a POC to a degree. But I think it's something that's going to make it into this product. I think it's quite an exciting space actually, because you know, again, you are, especially for large enterprise companies that have large teams and lots of engineers, you know, you're going to have engineers at different you know, experience levels, and when you know, rather than have these bottlenecks where only that person can help, oh, he's on leave, so now we can't do anything, you know, you have all of these kinds of issues. And I see it in all the enterprise companies that I work with, you know, giving that self-service back to the engineering team, and you know, they'll then learn from it as well. So, you know, maybe they don't become as dependent on the AI assistant, but I think having that helping hand to give them the ability to work out what the problems are themselves without going, oh, it's a platform problem, the platform team need to sort it out. I was like, well, that's not always the case, you know? We've actually got like a demo where we've used it on a particular like demo application that you can just find and download. And what the issue ended up being was that the data store wasn't pegged to a particular version. So it was pulling the latest image. So the application was using a feature that was deprecated in a later version of the database. So, but if you just look at what you're seeing, you wouldn't go like, oh, that's what the problem is. But the AI assistant came back and said, oh, you're using a deprecated feature of your data store. So that's what the problem is. And then you look and you go, oh, that's because I'm not pegging it to a particular version. I'd better peg it to a version or upgrade and change the feature if I want to use the latest version of my data store, you know. So just things like that. It's almost like a buddy that looks outside of the box for you. Do you know what I mean? To a degree. And that's kind of the space of where we are looking at as a use case for, I guess, the not companion, but the complementary usage of it. Because I think that's what it is, you know. It's, in my mind right now, a complementary tool, not a replacement, you know. I mean, like I said, an exciting space and a lot changing. Things are changing, you know, month on month. There's either new stuff or improvements or stuff again. And as things change and improve, you know, its usage will change and improve as well. So,
okay, that's interesting. I like how you frame it, because a lot of the example use cases that I've seen just seem, like, to me personally, just sort of quite pointless. Like, I can hum a song and then it'll know what my song is. It's like, okay, you're using all that compute power for that. I mean, look, sure, it's great. And then I had this moment yesterday where Little Miss was just, she started humming a song. I'm like, oh yeah, that's that song. And then, so I was like, okay,
what's
fine.
What's the name? Yeah.
It's like, I kind of do get it. But then when you kind of put a use case like this, it seems much more meaningful. Like, I guess the difference between someone who earned a fortune for being an influencer, right? It's like, what did you really contribute to the wider community versus someone who did well because they had an idea for, yeah, like something that really impacts a large group of people in I'll be biased, in a large meaningful way. Yeah. And that sounds like a decent use case to me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I think there's, as you will feel the same way as a technologist who's been, you know, been there in the trenches a number of years, you know, there are a lot of tasks that are almost cookie cutting. You know, there are a good example. There are a lot of languages, unfortunately, that are bulked out by this, like, almost additional code you need to add just because that's how the language works, you know, like Java, you know, your getters and setters, your hash to and equals methods, you know.
Nothing wrong with a setter, by the way.
but for every class you build, you've got to build all of those. And there have been things that have been, you know, added over the years. There's a couple of additional, like, features where they've tried to sort of, you know, use annotations to make it a bit easier, and then they added a compile time and all of that, you know. So, but there, I guess that's just one example of some cookie cutting stuff that I think can be sped up possibly by the use of these sort of assistant tools. But the interesting thing is, and actually yesterday I was watching a video about a review of Copilot, so the assistant tool that GitHub has, and the results are debatable. Do you know what I mean? Where, like, you know, he's kind of like, you know, you can see I'm doing this, and then it wants to auto complete for me, and you let it, but then you can spot the issue straight away if you are familiar enough. But if you're not and you're inexperienced, you're just going to go with it. And it's almost, you know, adding a bug in already. So, you know, you've got to be careful, I think, if you think it's going to write everything for you, that you're not introducing technical debt from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, AI technical debt. It'll probably be a new metric on our boards. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. AI introduced technical debt, you know?
Yeah. And one of those graphs that then say, like, here's what consumes, was it time on an average project? And you have like a new slice into the pie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Debugging AI generated code, or at least kind of reviewing it to see how accurate was it.
I think this is it. This is it. I think it still needs to be reviewed by a experienced engineer. Because again, like, the more I've used it, if you don't tell it exactly everything you want it to do, it either makes assumptions or just completely ignores those use cases, which is obvious. It doesn't know what you're thinking. You need to tell it, you know. So you have to be, and this is where the prompt engineering comes into it, you know. You need to, your prompt needs to be very accurate, and it needs to be very detailed so that it can do what you want it to do. It can't assume anything, you know, because imagine it does assume stuff, you're going to get some really weird outputs, I think, you know. So yeah, I think, to me, the jury's still out on the, you know, automated coding. I think it's still got quite a long way to go. It can do it. I don't necessarily think it's that good yet. That may change. But like I was saying, there are other, you know, sort of use cases. And around the API space, I'll give you another use case. The API space, you can have an API spec that, you know, hopefully you're following spec first, you know, building your spec before you build your API. You can then take that, as long as you've defined your schemas correctly, you can say, you know, lint my spec, lint it against like using Spectral, so the open API spec, and then take the outputs of that and feed it back in and say, here's my spec, this is what Spectral said, improve it based on the outputs of Spectral, and then do a continual loop while it improves the spec. And sort of, I suppose, fixes the linting issues, you know, rather than you manually having to do it. Now you think, okay, one API, you know, that's not going to save you much time. But imagine you had 500 APIs, you know, that would take you a very long time. And then you need example data in your spec so that you can do things like automated mocking, for argument's sake, you know? You could go there and go, oh, okay, well, let's go, you know, name Peter, you know, type rabbit, you know, like, you could try and make data up. I know there's sites that, you know, can kind of, but you could say to the assistant, you know, here's my spec, it has my schemas in it, add example responses to all of my status endpoints, you know. And it'll just go bam and add it to you. And again, one, not so impressive. 500, if you imagine you dumped 500 of these and you're told to improve them, that could be a, you know, a two to four year job if you're doing one API a week or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, it could take you forever or cost a lot because you need a team of people, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, Those kinds of use cases, I've seen it being pretty impressive. But yeah, like again, pick and choose them, I think, at the end of the day.
I think there were some really good points that you mentioned in there. And one of them was it kind of reminds me of that phrase, was it everything that's old is new again? And by that, in this case, I mean, you know, you have like, let's just say like you're a legendary developer. If you really write code, you know how a set of languages works. So you can do whatever it is that like the kind of software that you're developing, but you hadn't developed really the skills to say, well, to tease out of someone, what exactly do you want? Cause you know, you like all of us at different points in time get really excited. I've got a really good idea and it's going to be this. And in your head, it sort of seems to be fully formed. But then when it comes out to someone else who does not have any context, or nowhere near the context of references and so forth that you have, at least in your short-term memory. It's just there are sort of either gaping holes, or I'm not following what you mean. Like you when you mentioned this, did you mean A, B, or C? And when you mentioned this, could you clarify that? Because maybe, you know, like you've got two people just from different cultures, so just cultural references are missing. And so then you then have to, what would you say, tease out with them. When you talked about this, did you mean that, like as in what you specifically said? Or were you like inferring something, or were you leading to somewhere? So I guess in a good situation where you help someone see, oh, okay, I realize I wasn't as specific as I thought I was. Or, oh yeah, how would we get, like, we've gotten halfway through, but then there's this big sort of, what would you say, logic gap or whatnot. Okay, so how would we do that? And so what I mean by that, like, long-winded thing is when you say you got to give a good prompt so that it can give your AI, whatever it is, can give you that good answer. You then have to be very specific so that allowing for the data that it's trained on, whoever's developed it or the team and those factors, and maybe your culture to the cultures that it's come from, that it will give you an answer that is comprehensible and not, I can see where you went with that, but no, not what I'm looking for. And that, I guess of all of the things that I hear about it, about AI, and as good as it potentially can be, and as you've said, is already showing itself to be in certain areas, that aspect still seems to be something that at least is people are identifying it, saying you really have to be careful. But the other thing about it is I feel, I'm getting a sense that for people jumping on your proverbial AI bandwagon, it's as though AI will just magically do that and it will just fix everything. And you're like, oh, okay, seen this before somewhere, kind of, it'll just, this solution will just magically make the world come together and you just won't have to do anything. And you can just turn it on, say a few things, and then you'll just be, you know, your solution will be just ready. You'll be rolling in cash and it'll just happen. I'm sorry. That was a very meandering thought bubble, but.
No, but and it makes total sense. Like, I think, you know, it's requirements are requirements at the end of the day. You know, and you need to know what it is you want. Otherwise, you know, even if you're giving it to another person or you're giving it to AI, it's not going to be able to help you, you know. So it was one of those things I think I saw a meme or I don't know, something like that, where they were just like, you know, AI is going to replace developers. It's like, yeah, but you know, your customers, your clients still need to be able to, you know, clearly define their requirements, and they still can't do that. So, you know, there's no worry about us losing our jobs. And that's absolutely true. You know, like it's not a replacement. This is my thing. That's why I keep referring to it as a complementary tool, because I think it's another tool in our tool chest that as a technologist, I think we can pull out and use to possibly speed things up, you know. And I have used it to like start with a very bare bones, like do this, and it gives me a bare bones, and then I take it and kind of go and change it, you know. And sometimes the hardest thing is starting something, and once you started it, then actually tweaking it isn't too difficult, you know. So that's kind of, you know, how I've used it as well. You know, I kind of use it piecemeal here and there, just small little things rather than kind of big things. And I've found lots of problems as well where I've asked for something, I'm just like, no, that's not right. And then I'm like, no, that's not right. And it keeps going in a circle, and then eventually goes, okay, then you can't do it like that. You've got to do it like this. And they're like, I don't want to do it like that. And then it goes back into its circle again, you know. So there's definitely, but again, you have to understand the domain. You have to understand the space. It's not a ask a question, copy paste, you know.
It's not?
In the bank, you know.
Oh, I thought it was.
Is that not? Million.
Oh, okay. I don't want AI. No.
Absolutely not. Yeah. And to be honest, that's from like a technical standpoint. Like if you take it out of the technical space, another nice way of talking about it, and this is how I speak to, you know, sort of one of my colleagues as well, is we call it almost like a sparring partner, you know. A sparring partner when you want to do things like think of ideas around, let's just say, like a use case is I'm currently writing a case study on a particular sort of project I've worked on. I've got an idea of what I want to do, and I've used it as almost like a sparring partner for, like, you know, just designing the structure of how I want to build my case study. You know, how can I name my sections in a way that works, you know, for the context of the case study that I'm currently writing. And, you know, some of the stuff that's come out is actually pretty, I'm just like, wow, that's a really nice way of saying it, you know. Or it could be I don't want to call it that. But again, you know, like the time it probably would have taken me to have thought of a lot of these, I guess, ways of describing a particular topic or situation, you're getting that additional insight as a, well, why don't you call it this? Or you can say, give me 5 different ways of, you know, defining this particular topic, and it will come back with 5 different ways, you know. So almost as a sparring partner, kind of going like, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And then getting these kinds of ideas coming back. So as a tool like that, I think it's actually quite powerful, you know. And that's away from the technology to a degree, you know, because that's more around sort of English and language. And you know, it might even be I haven't tried it, but you could say, like, in German, how do I say this so that, you know, or what word could I use which would better describe, you know, and because often we know what it is we want, but don't necessarily know exactly what it is, you know.
Yeah.
So from that standpoint, I think there's quite a lot of.
But I like that point. I really do like the way you're describing it, because that sparring partner idea is good too, because there were, like, I watched this, probably mistakenly watched this video from a series of people who were saying, like, what we want to do is just, like, here are a whole series of worst case scenarios. Not that they're going to happen. Not that all of a sudden, you know, there'll be like lots of people looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger walking around, like appearing naked and from bubbles in the sky. You know, not that, but some of the things they seem to talk about were things like, well, it can just do it for me. Now it can just do this, and now it can do that, and now it can do that. So it's like, well, where is this going to end up from? And so I kind of perhaps extrapolated too far on a negative trajectory, but thought, well, if people say, well, let's extrapolate this too far, and let's say that that you just trust that it will write your emails for you. So little by little, well, why should I write them? So then little by little further, well, why should I write? Because it'll just do it. So if you get too far along that trajectory, well, you're not really in a position to review your work because you've lost the skills. But as you just said there, from the complete flip side of, no, you use it, I guess, like you would do in inspiring, like you would do in another form of review. Someone's like, well, how about use this phrase instead of that phrase? Who's more skilled perhaps than you are? And how about, well, I wouldn't use that phrase in this context because that might come across, that could go one of two ways. And one way is perhaps not so positive, not so endearing in a business context. So from that way, and what would you say, leapfrogging your knowledge and growth? Yeah, I really like that. I kind of feel very heartened by that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, we don't know where this is going, you know. So you know, in 2 years time, I might have a very different opinion because they've, you know, released GPT-10 and it's, you know, it's making my coffee as well, you know, in the morning. Yeah. Who knows, you know, but, you know, I think there's still a lot that needs to happen before it even gets anywhere near that kind of point, you know. And I always use this use case or this situation as an explanation. And it's quite funny, I guess, to a degree. But like, you know, people talk about like AI taking over the world. And I you know, my kind of argument to that is, well, I can't even travel on my train from where I live up to London with a stable internet connection to even just use like IM or check my emails. Like, and until they've fixed connectivity problems, you know, where I can at least do something as simple as that, we've got nothing to worry about. Do you know what I mean? You know, or just, you know, sort of live out in the country and then, you know, AI is not going to touch you. Do you know what I mean? Because we still have huge infrastructure and connectivity issues outside of the major cities, you know. And it's probably quite like that throughout the world. You know, you go out of the big hubs and they're not going to have as good a connection or very spotty connection. So yeah, I think there's still a long way to go. Again, we don't know what's going on in the labs. Maybe they've got, you know, some more exciting stuff that we will eventually be told about in a couple of years, but I can't see it as any form of replacement. So.
Yeah, I at first I kind of wondered because you get so many people saying, oh, it'll replace this, your job's has like a limited lifespan now, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, well, I've heard lots of stories. Like I was around, I think it was the early days for me in like the dot-com bubble. And I don't even remember now the claims that were being made around then, but anything that had tech in its name or IT or computer in its name was given like this massive valuation and then it crashed and then came the next wave. And there were like waves before I was even born and when I was growing up. So I kind of take these things of, oh, well, which jobs will not be around in 5 years, 10 years with a massive bucket of salt, not just a grain. The thing that does, I guess the best way to describe it is leaving me a little unsettled, is this sort of race to ram it into anything. And I mean, legitimately, not just the people who just stick AI in their name and say, look, we're AI now. And it's like, it's just branding, mate. It's,
yeah.
And to quote, I think it was is it Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, who said they were working at, and I quote, a frantic pace. It's like anything that can impact, well, really anything other than, I don't know, maybe making birthday cards. Do you want to be doing it at a frantic pace? Because there are implications of just get it out the door. And if we'll bring into this context their historical record of just ramming stuff out, and the first versions were just at least dating back to Windows, early versions of Office, earlier versions of Windows, actually not so early. And it just like the first version that shipped is just let someone else touch it, because it's going to crash your machine, it will take your work, all that. And then they gradually got better with each subsequent release or service pack or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And just saying frantic is not inspiring me with confidence that you're thinking about what are the implications of what we're doing. Does it even work properly? So let's just assume it turns out nice, right? But it's just awkward and weird. So people are getting all sorts of weird answers and it's not what I asked for. And you've got to keep like giving, like refining your prompt. And as you say, you go through that circle. At the most harmless, this idea of frantically having it everywhere, fear of missing out, all that stuff. And so people trying to just ram it into what they do is not inspiring.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it kind of also, you know, if we look at it from a, I guess, ethical standpoint as well, you know, it's there's been this whole debate around companies owning, you know, should these models and stuff be owned by, should they be proprietary? Should they be owned by companies, or should they be part of the open source community? You know, should it be because as soon as companies own it, they add it to their products, like you were saying, you know, then they can effectively make it do whatever they want it to, because it's theirs. They own the model, you know. So it does sort of open that up. And I watched this really interesting interview, funnily enough, probably one of the best I've seen of old Tesla guy, Elon Musk. And they interviewed him about OpenAI. And he effectively fronted them the money to start the business. But he did it, he gave them the name, he says. And OpenAI was because it was meant to be a non-profit organization. It was meant to be for non-profit, and now they're effectively making a profit because they're selling the licenses for using it. You know, that opens the whole thing of, well, should this not have been an open, you know, platform, an open technology, an open model that is. However it gets managed, I wouldn't know the technical way of how you would do it, but you know, letting the open source community actually work on it together rather than companies, because what will happen eventually is each version of every company is going to have their stance on it, because they're going to want it to do something particular because it's their version of it, you know, or you know, they own it, so they're pushing it one direction. And then, you know, then you just start getting divergence of what the technology should have or could have done, you know.
No, I think you got a good point. And like, I will be quite open about it. I'm biased to an open source or the British author, was it Monbiot? So it's calling something owned by in the commons. So it's not by an individual, it's not by a company, it's not by the state, it's more the group, like just the community at large, really. But that's not, I'm not trying to infer like socialism or communism to go that way either. Just the community that is affected or helped by it has the overall kind of what would you say, are all invested in guiding it. Because I think there were some excellent examples what was it? Is it SSL? TLS SSL spec, of them saying like, this is a hard problem. This is not, even if you're a genius, a child prodigy on your, like no one person can develop this with the breadth and scope that it requires for it to be truly mature. And so that's what you have, like, you know, contributors from Northern Pakistan to Southern South Africa to Midlands in England kind of thing, all looking at it, all who are experienced to different degrees in mathematics, in security and cryptography, saying, you know, and querying it, critiquing it, even just asking questions. But then there's an open record of that to be seen. So that I would like to think that also holds you a bit more to account, saying anybody could look at it and look at my contributions. And there was one good example of, I think it was, is it RSA Inc., the American company? And it was for the development. I heard this on the Security Now podcast a couple of years ago. And they said that there was a proposal put forward to, is it SSL or TLS3? Which was rejected. Sorry, it was put forward by RSA Inc. And it was rejected because some of the developers said, look, I can't be 100% sure of the impacts of this proposal to the spec, but looking at it, I'm leaning to think that this could backdoor the spec when implemented. And on top of that, given that your history of collaboration with the NSA and given that the knowledge had come out through Snowden and all the others, over the 5 years prior, it's like, this is too hot to touch. So we're going to, I think that those who had voting rights said, we're going to reject your contribution because just not sure. But they said on its own, if you just looked at the contribution without any context, it's like, it smells, but maybe I'm not sure, but through all those sets of eyes, at least this was, I think their contribution did ultimately get through, but it was added with an optional flag. It was by default, it was disabled or something, or would be disabled in official implementations. And it could be enabled or whatnot. But without those sets of eyes, and with it being all kind of perhaps done behind closed doors with people who perhaps are beholden to, well, if I say no to this, how does this affect my career? How does this, will I be shunted out the door because I'm not a team player? All those sorts of things that rightly or wrongly can happen, I think, kind of in a commercial organization. And then you've got a commercial interest to push a certain thing. And as you've said, and as it was exemplified, I think, in the Unix wars, prior to Unix becoming something that was, well, now this is ours and we can sell this, it was just developed in the commons. And so it was kind of, it was this, what would you call, like a broad church, I think the term is. But then it became, oh, no, this can, we can make money of this. And then the wars happened and it kind of progress slowed to a halt. It pretty much decimated itself and it allowed something like, was it Windows to come through? Because they were fighting each other and they were adding features, sometimes replicating features, but well, we can't get yours because then we'd have to maybe pay you like a license for that. So we're going to implement it ourselves again. And all this, so I don't know, as I can only say, is just this complete kind of waste of potential. So yeah, I agree. Just, I get a bit funny when what's going on and in some cases of you get, like a significant backer, say, I think Microsoft put $1 billion into OpenAI. And it's like, well, we're a significant contributor. I want that. The community, everybody else says, well, that's a really bad idea. It's like, no. If you don't do this, I'm going to pull the funding or I won't fund you another round. So when this money runs out, it'd be terrible if we just didn't feel you were a priority to us.
Yeah, and that to me is the worry, you know. And like you were saying, I think it's the whole slowing down of progress, you know, that I think will happen in a community, you know, open source community. I think there will be more progress. There's more people working on it, you know, but. The company-based ones, the proprietary-based ones, are going to be only what works for the company. And if there is something that maybe competes with the company, or and you're like, oh no, we can't add that, it's like, but actually, that would make the technology brilliant. You know, they're not going to add it. And then imagine it's only companies that are building these things. They're, you know, that completely stifles, you know, advancements of technology. So.
Yeah,
it's an interesting one at the moment, and I think it's probably going to be debated for a number of years. There are people that are producing sort of open source models, and you never know, like operating systems, we may end up with a which model are you using? Oh, you're using the whatever, which is the open source, you know. Flavor, like you use Linux or Unix versus, you know, Windows and Mac, it might end up in that kind of camp, you know, where you select which one you want, but they're all as good as each other, but have different, you know, capabilities or different advantages depending on how you use it, you know. So I know where I'll be heading. I'll be heading down the Linux Unix version of the model for sure.
Yes.
And not any of the others, because that's I'm like you know, very very much in the open source camp. So there are some paid for proprietary things that are useful, but I think overall, as long as if I can do it open source, I'll do it open source for sure. So yeah,
same. I want to sort of be fair as well to like, I don't think companies are necessarily bad. Don't get me wrong. Or would you say private companies? Cause you can get like an extreme focus, I guess, if perhaps you have like cash on the line kind of thing. It's like, we want to get razor focused. Whereas I guess in a community driven thing, you're going to have too many voices perhaps, and who, what are we really going to do? So I appreciate pros and cons, and I'm just looking at my desk here of the hardware I've got sitting here. I know it was made, two items made by a private company. I just think that if you have a company that is driven by a sense of purpose of, we want to make something that is really reliable and solid, and you're really invested or part of a community. So you have a sort of a sense of accountability that way. I feel I've seen a lot that do really well, like some amps and guitars and stuff. They say, like, we're guitarists ourselves. We go to gigs, that sort of stuff. You know, if we don't do something decent, people just won't touch it. Whereas I've seen others perhaps in the VC camp. I'm not really a VC funded kind of person. I just feel in certain instances that it's more about profit. It's not really about something that you're creating. And this is like no specific names. I'm just saying that's just a feeling that I have, is it's more about profit and quotas than we're really passionate about. Yeah. Making, what do you call it? Was it like Fender guitars or Marshall amps? We really love doing this stuff. We use them every chance we can. People love using it because, you know, we're invested. We go to concerts, we help out, all that. That the two different focuses, I guess.
No, it's a very fair point. And it's we can't tarnish them all with the same brush, I think. And you're absolutely right, you know. I think it can be less clear the bigger the organization, unfortunately. You know, and I think the ones that have been around since the start of computers, you know, they're almost too big, unless, you know, there's another arm that gets branched off, which maybe can, you know, work like a startup, work, you know. Otherwise, what happens is it just gets eaten up by the bureaucracy and enterprise process. Stuff that happens in all these large organizations, and then that's often what stifles progress, unfortunately. So hopefully, you know, the people that are leading this, they do, you know, take that into account, and it doesn't end up, you know, I guess like some other technologies have. And but yeah, I guess time will tell, and hopefully opinions within, you know, the tech community will hopefully help guide that as well. So
yeah, hopefully it'll even if it gets a bit rocky, it starts to come good.
Yeah, but I think the one nice part of what we spoke about today is that it's not always all about the tech. There's also the other side of it to think about, you know what I mean? Almost from a, you know, sort of holistically looking at the implications of decisions that are made on the tech, where it's used and stuff like that, you know. So I think I think people get bogged down in just talking about the tech and how to use it and all of that, but actually there's probably a lot else you can talk about the whole thing as well, you know. So that was quite nice, and I liked hearing your opinion on it as well, which was great. Thank you, it was great.
So what did you think of the session with Andrew? Personally, I still love listening to it. On going through it to edit the episode, it still gave me a lot more to think about. It's helped me be not quite so hesitant in some areas, but perhaps strangely or conflictingly more so in others. I got a lot out of it. I hope you did too. If you'd like to know anything more about the episode, head on over to podcast.webdevwithmatt.com. You'll find all the show notes for this episode, links where you can find out more about Andrew and everything that we talked about. If you did like it, I'd love it if you could give me like a review, thumbs up and so forth. If you could subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. And with that said, I'll see you next time.